Welcome to another edition of the Album Raw here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online, RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. I'm AD Packham, and we're not blaming BT Sport for anything in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Well, last Saturday saw Liverpool visit the Amex and leave with just a point off the late VAR drama. Pascal Gross netted a deserved equaliser from the spot, but in truth, we were disappointed to only get a point after we had chances to send the champions home with nothing. On Monday, not only did we welcome Southampton to the Amex, but also 2,000 lucky fans who will get to see us in league action for the first time since March. In other news, the FA Cup third round draw was made this week, and we will travel to Wales to face Newport County on the 9th of January. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares, and we're delighted to be joined by another Raw Virgin who has just published a book entitled From the Gutter to the Stars. Please welcome Mr. Simon Medhurst. Welcome to the show, Simon. Lovely to see you.
Cheers, AD.
And as is normal for a Raw Virgin, tell us about you and your album supporting history.
Okay, well, I'm Simon Medhurst. I'm known on North Stand Chat as Lettuce. The Lettuce bit means no references to Southampton whatsoever. One of my favourite players was Dean Saunders, and I thought it was a travesty when Tiltman was in, Saunders was sold. So Lettuce is Tiltman in, Saunders sold. So that's me on social media. In terms of my background, I started life as a hammer. Early childhood memories were going to Upton Park, great. Then my dad, in the early 70s, started taking me to this wonderful place called the Goldstone Ground. Did a few friendlies because I wasn't particularly that big at that particular time. And it went from there, really. So mid-70s, started to get really into it. Played with Dennis Burnett and one only, Harry Wilson. And Harry Wilson, I think the reason I liked him, I guess, was one that he played in front of the West Stand for one of the halves, right in front. He was always a lot of endeavour, not particularly skillful, but he tried his hardest, bless him. And I think the other thing is he had strawberry blonde hair, because at that time, honestly, at that time, my favourite player for West Ham was Harry Redknapp. And also the other side I followed up north of the border was Celtic, and they had a guy called Jimmy Johnson. I don't know if you remember him. So it must have been a strawberry blonde thing. Anyhow, so yeah, really, really tiny. Yeah. So that was that. And then in the late 70s, it just took off, didn't it? It was a wonderful experience. It was exhilarating, absolutely. And, you know, it was one of those special moments in my life. And it hasn't really been replicated since, despite us getting to the Premier League. It was really passionate. It was just spellbounding for a kid. And I loved it. So I was hooked.
Was your old man a hammer?
No, my old man, for his sins, is a Tottenham Hotspur supporter. So I had to venture to White Hart Lane. But West Ham was, I think they were multicultural. They were just flair. And they had one player that really made a difference. And that was Bobby Moore. Mm-hmm. I played centre half and he was just magnificent. And as I said, there was I used to collect football cards. And the one that stood out in my collection, because the strawberry blonde that he used, was Harry Redknapp. And there was a fascination. And I went to a game, my first game, because I'd done the 92 Football League rounds. And my first game was at Upton Park against Nottingham Forest. And I was hooked. But then I got weaned off by this wonderful thing called the Goldstone Ground.
The Goldstone Ground then? What was it about the Goldstone? I mean, because you could have easily stayed with West Ham. You could have followed your dad to Spurs. What was it about the Goldstone?
One, it was Sussex. I think there was an affinity there. Obviously closer to home. And I started going more regularly and it just felt more personal. West Ham, don't get me wrong, Upton Park was amazing place to watch football. And it's a bit of a travesty they've lost it. But the Goldstone was just, it just felt more real and down to earth. And obviously the Endeavour, I could get right at the front. I used to stand to start with the West Stand, right at the front in the terracing. And I was right by the pitch. And I suppose that's the reason I had a fascination with Harry Wilson, really, because he was playing right in front. But it was just amazing place. It was a cold ground. It had brilliant atmosphere, didn't it? And then later in life, I got wiser, older, and decided to go into the North Stand. And that itself was an experience. And you look at football in the 70s, it's so much different now. And the Goldstone Ground captured exactly that, didn't it? It just did.
I have to ask, what's your opinion of Harry Redknapp now?
He's ruined a lot of football clubs, hasn't he? No, certainly, Harry Redknapp is obviously, because my old man's a Spurs fanatic, he wouldn't have a bad word said against him. So, no, he is good at what he does. He's a real character, a real personality. And I think football needs a Harry Redknapp. And certainly he's brought a sparkle into the football game. And he's become a personality. And, yeah, he's part of my life, really. As a little kid, he was a bit of a hero.
So you've been watching footy for about 50 years now, off and on, including going to the Albion. So for, 47, 48 of those years? In that time, can you pick, A, your favourite, and B, the person you thought was the best footballer? They're not necessarily one and the same. They might be. But who is your best, and who do you think was, and who was your favourite?
Right. I'm going to stick with Albion. My favourite player ever was Mark Lawrenson. I thought he produced the best quality performances over a period of time than any Brighton player. He was superb, a total footballer, somebody who could play centre-half but then step equally into the midfield role, which he did. And he was just amazing. He defied logic, that guy. His speed of recovery in the defence was second to none. He was definitely the best player that played for Brighton Hove Albion. My favourite player in terms of the best footballer to wear a blue and white shirt, I think, is Vicente. I think the way that guy stroke of football, the way that guy was balanced, the way he played football was just amazing. Unfortunately, he played less than 30 games for us. I got to see most of them, and that guy, I know he's at the end of his career, but he was second to none in terms of talent. I don't know if you went to the friendly against Chelsea.
Yeah.
When they were European champions, he was the best player on the pitch by miles that day, and they had all their stars out.
It's very odd that, because there's, throughout the Albion's history, there's a few players who've had a major impact but had very, very few games. I mean, you think the likes of Frank Worthington, of Hans Gray, who are actually the same side. But I mean, but you know, these names that are names that are, are linked with Sergei Gotsmanov as well. Yeah, I mean, you know, these are players that have gone down in the annals of Albion history as heroes. I wouldn't say legends necessarily, but I mean, absolutely, you know, they have a, what's the word I'm looking for? An iconic place in our history, I suppose.
I guess so. Yeah, well, they made their stamp even over 15 games or 20 games, whatever it might have been. Not quite sort of Frank Stapleton's one or two games where, let's face it, he was indistinguishable from the size that I am now. But yeah, if you're talking about that quartet of Worthington and Vicente, and I still actually maintain, I'll take your point, Simon, completely about Vicente, the way he could stroke the ball around. I'm going to say that that's actually going to be up there with Frank Worthington. Now, you saw Worthington at his best, and then you saw him at the tail end of his career with the Albion. I reckon you could make a comparison with those two, you know.
Certainly. I mean, obviously, it was a privilege watching Frank Worthington. He came to the Goldstone just prior to joining us for Bolton, I think, and he just held the ball up so well, and he made football look easy.
Yeah,
you could say he was lazy, but I just think he knew his trade and he mastered it without a doubt. His control was second to none. He was silky and he just made football look easy, didn't he?
I mean, we were saying this about Diego Maradona last week, about these players that had these amazing silky skills, but they were doing it on what was effectively a ploughed field. And like the likes of like we said, like Worthington and Best, all these players that were playing on these really, really shocking surfaces. Just imagine what they could do on the bases that we have these days. It's just shocking. But speaking of bases we have at the moment, we were in action at the Amex last Saturday. We had the visit of the champions, Liverpool. And Graham Potter named his side, and he decided that attack was the best form of defence, and he named the kitchen sink.
Did he? I don't remember him.
Much.
Was he a left back?
Yeah, that's it. But I mean, it was a very, very attacking side that he named. We had a forward line of Connolly, Morpay, and Welbeck. Obviously, Joel Boltman came in for the suspended Tariq Lamptey. Now, Liverpool started the game really brightly, and actually, sitting there watching it, it actually looked like Robertson was going to have Veltman on toast for most of the afternoon. But we, apart from that one early chance that Salah had, we settled into the game really well, and we should have been home and hosed by half time.
We didn't give away the two silly early goals. That's the difference between this season and last season. I mean, we're still getting maddeningly sort of infuriated about certain bits and pieces that players are doing. But what we're not doing, and it might be a change of personnel, or it might just be the kick up the backside they've all had, is that we're not giving away those early silly goals against the big sides. You know, we did it against Man U early season, last season. We did it against Chelsea. And it does your head in. This time we didn't do it and we made a game of it. So it was actually a lot easier to get into Liverpool's faces. And it's kind of interesting that I think that the Potter had Klopp here because he knew the limitations of his defence. And yeah. Simon, it was kind of interesting to see Aaron Connolly being a kind of classic number nine of playing the ball over the top.
Yeah, well, I totally endorse everything you said. I thought Graham Potter got his tactics exactly right. He saw how vulnerable they were at the back. And obviously the tactic was for Aaron to run behind them. And he'd done that superbly. Obviously he should have possibly done better with his chance. But I thought it was a great move by Potter. He's had a lot of criticism recently. And, you know, team selection is hard to call under his guys. But that's quite good in terms of it's exciting and he surprises other teams. And he did exactly that. He certainly did exactly that. And I thought Connolly was a real thorn in their side.
Yeah, I mean, one particular tactic which was picked up on was the fact that they had young Nathaniel Phillips in the back line, who was the most inexperienced player in that team. And we marked everyone else but him, so the ball had to go through him every time. We were pressuring, and then we put the pressure on him.
I thought he did quite well, actually.
Yeah, well, he had to because he was seeing way more of the ball than he normally would do. It was good. I mean, but that chance, I mean, it was more play who played Connolly through.
It was just a simple ball, and the point is that they have seen and actually done their homework on seeing what a. You know, if you're going to play a high line against that and a high line that's not particularly quick, then it's actually sort of fairly obvious. I think Liverpool did play into our hands a little bit in as much as they did push forward more than they needed to without realising what they did or didn't have. I mean, it's not as though they didn't do their homework on us. They know that Connolly's quick. They know that he's actually the kind of a little bit of an anti-Weeble. But... and they also know that he can be exceptionally infuriating when it comes to finishing. He'll either stick it in the bottom corner, thank you very much, good night, Vienna, or it'll end up in row Z. So, you know, I don't think they were actually sort of taking their chances on, right, assuming that in a one-on-one he's going to miss. But, you know, they were actually, when it came to their defence, you know, found horribly wanting at times.
But that's all a chance... So I mean, it's one that strikers dream of. It should be bread and butter for them. And one which they would practice in training on a regular basis. I mean, every day, in the warm-up, in every game, you see players going through those warm-up drills of exactly that. It's just frustrating because, I mean, we do have this habit of creating a lot of chances in games and clear-cut chances like this as well and not taking them and then coming away with nothing.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's a theme, isn't it? It's been a theme for a while. We've tried different people, my view is it will come. I think we're starting to see us become a better attacking side. I think our forward play is far superior to what it has been in the past. I think we're starting to create them, and I think it will come. Mope is definitely lacking confidence at the moment. You could see that when he put the ball down. I don't know if you noticed on TV. He couldn't get the ball to settle, but his hands were shaking. And I just think it's a confidence thing. And I think if we get the strikers scoring, it will come. And I think we've made some good acquisitions. I think Welbeck is a different proposition to what we've got. And I think he complements what we've got. And I think we will see us the second half of the season a better Brighton Hove Albion and more confident and scoring more goals. Because the chances we're creating is top of the league stuff, isn't it? We're almost like a Harry Kane away from a top 10 side, aren't we?
The thing is, with that chance, when you see the difference between the one-on-one that Welbeck had at Villa and the one-on-one that Connolly had against Liverpool, I mean, if that was Welbeck that had been running through, and for all the fact that he is actually considered this sort of like, you know, groaning old granddad, he's not. He's still got a little bit of pace about him. I'd have stuck my mortgage. Well, I don't have a mortgage, but I would have stuck AD's mortgage on Welbeck sticking that at home. Yeah. But with Connolly and with Morpay, like I say, I think even Connolly, I don't know, he's a funny beast. But your point about Morpay, I mean, AD, we'll talk about the penalty, but I have to say his confidence looks absolutely shot to pieces.
It does. It does in front of goal. I mean, his all-round play is actually very good, and it was actually Morpay who set the chance up. It was actually him that actually set up that chance for Connolly.
Yeah.
He's holding the ball up okay, but in front of goal, he's just not quite got it at the moment. But it's frustrating. He's picked up a knock. It looks like he is going to be fit for Monday.
Do you think that was a diplomatic injury on Saturday? Do you think that was
a bruised ego? No, I don't think so.
Simon, you're giggling, mate.
I said to our chat that he cried off. That was a term that we used to use when people played in our teams. Whether he did or not, I don't know. He's obviously a volatile character. He's a quality footballer. I watched him at Bournemouth last season. We had a horrendous performance against Bournemouth. But you're close to the ground at Bournemouth and you could see his movement. He works his socks off. His movement is great. His quality, he pulls defenders all over the place. But he is lacking confidence, but he does seem a temperamental character as well. Yeah. And I just think it got in his head, I think, personally.
He does wear his heart on his sleeve. I mean, we were saying...
Straight and knockout?
Yeah, my dad says he's a spit.
Maybe. But let's just before we come on to the penalty, let's just go on to Aaron Connolly. Because, I mean, okay, it was a badness. And one that he would probably score 9 times out of 10. It's just unfortunate that the one time he does miss, it happens in a big match. He was an absolute menace in this game, and he did not let that Liverpool defence settle for a second. He was harrying them, he was chasing them, he was moving them all over the pitch, and it was, you know, he was an absolute live wire, and it was actually him that did actually win the penalty.
I hate that phrase, win the penalty.
I know you do. That's why I used it.
Don't win a penalty. Well, the thing is, it was that same... Do you remember the game towards the end of season last season? It was Nico Williams. He played left back. He started at left back. And Lamptey stuck him in his pocket, basically. And he was substituted at half-time. And Graham Souness could not understand why. And just about everyone else could, because he's a walking red card, Souness, you wally. Lamptey had, I think he had about 4 goes before he finally got a yellow card against him. And Lamptey was just going to have him brutally. So he got substituted at half time. Now, I just can't help thinking there's an element of the fact that Nico Williams was our best player in both games against Liverpool, because that penalty really was naively clumsy.
Yeah, didn't actually have to go to VAR. It was.
Well, they all go to VAR.
I think it was a stonewall, cast iron,
nailed on, all day long. Here. Any other Simon that we've missed out? What else is there apart from stonewall?
Yeah, well, I'm a defender. Can I make a plea to football to bring back the art of tackling? Because Ben White did a Bobby Moore-esque tackle.
Yes,
the one he got booked for.
Yes. Got booked for, and it went to VAR for a potential red card. It was an amazing challenge. It should have been lauded.
To say that's 2 yellow cards that Ben White has got this season, both against big sides, and both were absolutely ludicrous. There was whoever it was he tackled against Liverpool. Perfect tackle.
Jota, I think it was.
And the one against Manchester United, Luke Shaw goes on this huge, great big arcing run, this curved run, in order to clatter into Ben White to make it look as though White had actually impeded him. 2 absolutely ridiculous yellow cards. You're quite right, Simon. I mean, the tackle of Ben White in that Liverpool game, absolutely perfect. Even Steve McManaman and his red-dyed perm and his red dyed vocal inflections. He said, that's a perfectly good tackle. No idea. The reason that White's legs went up in the air is because Jota, if you're saying it's Jota, then I'll go with it. Jota clattered into him.
Exactly that. What can you do? He did everything perfectly. He got the ball, he watched the ball, got the ball, but the player went over him.
Yeah. And it wasn't even, to be fair, not even, you could argue if it's anything, it should be a foul by Jota. Yeah. But it's not as though something Jota intended to do. Ben White just stood his ground.
Okay, so Morpai put the penalty wide, and you just felt that we were going to be punished for our profligate finishing. And as we know, he then limped off as well. Trossard came on for him, or, well, I think he did. I didn't really notice. Liverpool did actually have the ball in the back of the net through Mo Salah. And it was just one of those VAR interceptions that you just don't want to see, really. I mean, it was a toenail offside. And, if you're level, you're onside. I mean, these VAR rules are just getting a little bit too finickety. I mean, let's face it, it was there to stop goal hanging, Simon.
Yeah, no, exactly that. And football, I thought, got it about right. And I was hoping that VAR would improve the offside position. But I think it's done worse than that because it's taken the control away from the referee as well. I have seen some stuff from Holland where they put another line.
They've made the line thicker.
Yeah. So and providing your body's within that, it makes perfect sense. But,
Sorry, what they know in Holland?
They've made the line that judges you to be on or offside. They've actually made that line thicker. So basically, in other words, giving the advantage to the attacker.
And I think we all want that. I mean, regardless of the fact that it was a Liverpool goal, it was a quality goal, and it was one that football should laud, isn't it? Really, again.
I mean, it's got ridiculous. I mean, I know that the goal was against Palace, and we should all be applauding that. But there was the Patrick Bamford goal where he was pointing where he wanted the ball.
Yeah.
And they gave him off because his arm where he was pointing was offside. I mean, it's got ludicrous. And yes, it was a goal against us, but quite frankly, there was nothing wrong with it.
I think it was ultimately it was one of his feet, and that was it, wasn't it? So
it wasn't even his foot. It was like a quarter of a toe. And when you look at the line,
there was a defined line that I saw on the telly. So, yeah, I mean,
to the letter of the law, yes. But yeah. I mean, it. But you can talk about screen like the screen rates and things like that. It's just utterly, utterly ridiculous. Yeah, but anyway, we got away with one. We'll take it all day long. But we carried on. We had chances. Trossard, both had chances without working the keeper. Well, but then ran up the red defence and cut inside and got a shot away, which was an easy save for Alisson. Should he have passed, though? This is a beautiful move from Welbeck.
I remember that bit. And I actually also was thinking, yes, he probably should have taken the shot because the two forwards were not in a position to receive it. So, you could see then Welbeck looks at his players and then say, should I have passed it? Shouldn't I have passed it? I'm sorry, guys, blah, blah, blah. But the upshot of it was, I didn't see the other two were actually in a position particularly to receive it.
Now, like Simon, I was fortunate enough to be at the game on Saturday, and I did actually make a point of actually watching Danny Welbeck very, very closely in my own personal Welbeck cam. I'm just so impressed with him to the point where I don't think, and this might be controversial, I don't think he's the best Brighton striker I've seen for probably about 10 years.
Since including Glenn Murray.
Well, he's a bit more mobile than Glenn Murray. I'm a bit more mobile than Glenn Murray. I love Glenn. Don't get me wrong, I love Glenn. But I mean, his movement, the way he takes on a defence. He's a complete striker. Technically he still is an England international and he wants to get back into that setup. And if he carries on improving the rate that he is at the moment and getting back up to fitness, then there's no reason why he might not get
he is a superb athlete. He's obviously not been very fortunate with injuries, but I've always rated him. I can remember seeing Preston when he was on loan there as a young lad, and he looked strong and athletic, pacey. And obviously his career has been a good one, but blighted a bit with injury. I didn't see a lot of him at Watford, but apparently his performances weren't great. But I was pleased when we signed him for all the reasons I said earlier. He complements what we've got. He's powerful. We needed a mobile Glenn Murray. He's that type of player. He's athletic. He's powerful. I think it's how we're going to use him. In recent years, he seems to be used more as a wide player. And I'm not so sure. I wouldn't mind him running down the middle with the two lads or one of the two lads off of him.
I think in this game, he was started on the right of the three with Connolly, the most central, and which I mean, we spoke about him being a menace, but I think you're right. I would like to see him more centrally. I think he was more central against Aston Villa. Obviously,
they're all actually interchangeable. That's the point.
That's good movement.
Yeah, Mopo sometimes was on the left and Welbeck was up in the middle, or you'd have had Connolly, certainly in the first half, because he was running in behind, was a lot more central a lot of the time. But you have to then remember that ball that we were talking about a few minutes ago of Mopo over the top for Connolly. Mopo was in a fairly central position at the time, so they are all totally interchangeable. And I think it's just the nature of any given striker. There's not that many who are what you would call a centre forward. I mean, you see Harry Kane comes back a lot. The idea of this big number nine leading the line these days is actually a fairly old-fashioned way of looking at it.
Right.
You know, the fella in the middle, you know, effectively a goal hanger is not a thing.
I think in the case of Kane, that's because his legs aren't quite what they were, and he sees himself more of a quarterback these days. But but I mean, he's very good at it, and his assists this season have been
amazing.
And the relationship he has with Son is great. But
this 10 years thing with Danny Welbeck. Well, how far back? Who is he?
I mean, I don't.
He's better than. Who's the best than him?
I can't. You know what? I can't think of one at the moment. I just think that there's so much more to his game than I've seen from any of the strikers that we've had recently. I mean, he's got everything. He's got pace. He can hold the ball up. He's good in front of goal. Obviously, we're not seeing an awful lot of his finishing at the moment because, like Simon said, he does seem to be a little bit wide. But he's not afraid to get that shot off. And he's had four or five opportunities where a chance would have gone begging. It would have gone fruited out to nothing. But he's taking on that shot and he's working the goalkeeper. Sure. And I will never have a go at anyone for trying to score a goal for a team and taking on that shot. Because quite often we see, oh, it's been passed backwards. It's gone off. It's gone out for a goal kick. It's exciting. And I think there's a lot more to come from him.
Absolutely.
Anyway, Liverpool did actually get a legitimate goal, and it was that man Jota, who gave them the lead, who's been absolutely wonderful for them, great signing for them, but he was giving way too much time and space in the box to actually get that finish away.
I disagree. I think he created his own time and space. I mean, he made it look easy, and in the way that, you know, when we were talking about earlier, Worthington or Vicente or even Maradona, that's not to say that you're going to compare him to them. I think he created his own space and he made it look, you know, as soon as he was in the box, then there was, I wouldn't say the Albion defence started panicking, but they could see that he was actually looking for that little bit of room. I'm more inclined to credit Jota than I am to blame the Albion defence. Did someone go to ground a bit easily? Not sure, but no, I want to credit the striker here. It's the sort of thing that Welbeck could easily have done as well.
Simon?
I know the pundits lauded again the dummy by Jota. Jota's a good player, and I think he would put most quality defenders on the ground. At one stage as a defender, you've got to put the block in, and he looked like he was pulling the trigger, and he dummied it superbly.
Mm. Okay, just after the goal, Adam Lallana entered the fray, and then he left 8 minutes later.
That was a cheese for Connolly, wasn't it?
I, to be honest, I wouldn't have taken Connolly off as well. He was causing so many problems. I can see kind of what he was trying to do, but it obviously didn't work. He backfired. His groin wasn't quite set from the injury he picked up at Villa. And he knew. He didn't even wait to be substituted. He just ran straight off.
I think what the thinking with the substitution, though, AD, was that Liverpool had their lead. They weren't playing brilliantly, and they were defending a little bit deeper. Now, the point about Connolly and what he was able to offer was that when Liverpool were pressing a higher line, there was more space which someone like him could exploit. When Liverpool were dropping back that 10 yards, that 15 yards, there was less space for Connolly to exploit. And therefore, that's when he wanted a different setup. The fact it was Lallana that came on rather than anyone else, I think is unfortunate. I mean, Lallana would be the obvious one to come on, and we realise how broken he can be. But, you know, I think another midfielder could have done the job. I mean, you know, we know about Ben White playing in midfield. No one's got a problem with him doing that. You know, there's stuff to consider. Yeah, I mean, it looked bad when a sub is subbed, and it looks bad on the manager when you think, well, hang on, how bad was the injury? But I think that Connolly had pretty much maybe another 5 minutes, but other than that, pretty much run his race because I think Liverpool had changed their shape a bit.
Simon, go on.
All it was, I endorse all of the things you said, but the other thing is they brought on Henderson and he started running the midfield. And they started to dominate the midfield. And I think it was to counter that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. So, Simon, the question I was going to ask you was, there's a lot of talk at the moment about going back to having the five subs. What do you think of that?
I think it's fair that they do. Particularly the bigger clubs. Their work schedule at the moment is frantic. And I think most squads now are decent enough. I mean, you look at us, we're leaving decent players out of the match day squad. So, does it give the bigger teams advantage? Probably yes, it does. But I think the players' welfare should be put first. And I think five should be used. I think it worked well last time around.
Well, last season, Simon, I think in all the games we had left, there was only one game where Graham Potter didn't use all five subs.
Well, the point about it is that if you're going to ask anyone, do you favour it or do you not favour it? I think that actually the marker you should be really looking at is, does the manager of your club want it? And Paul Barber was speaking to Mark Chapman this week on The Athletic, and Graham Potter's attitude is he does want them. Now, the next manager, you know, would Chris Hughton have wanted it? Not sure. So I would be of the mind to say, well,
it's very difficult to make five substitutes in the 85th minute, Al.
Well, you can only do them in three windows anyway. But the point is, if I would go along with what the manager of your club wants. I know it sounds. Go on.
It's the Sheffield United manager whose name just
Chris Wilder,
yeah, former Melbourne player. Of course. He definitely doesn't want it. I know that. Sean Dyche doesn't want it, but these are the players. These are the clubs with the thinner squads. So,
I think the status quo is prevailing, and I don't think that it's actually going to go back to five from nine rather than three from seven. But you know, yes, it's an interesting point, and if there's going to be a five from nine, then it's going to be if Liverpool got the ump because they're playing in Europe as well. Then maybe this should have a separate European squad.
It's not so much that. I mean, basically, because of the short turnaround, the players haven't had the rest. I mean, yeah, everyone looks at, oh, look at these overpaid prima donna professional footballers earning all this money. At the end of the day, they're human beings, they're professional athletes. Their bodies need time to recover. it's, you know, and because of the short turnaround between the two seasons and not having the necessary rest in the summer and coming straight back and not necessarily having a full pre-season, we're seeing Brighton largely have been okay with the injuries, but
well, we're not in Europe as well.
But I mean, we're seeing it across the rest of the other teams. The Championship have now adopted a five-sub thing. They're using it across Europe. I think it's only a matter of time before it comes back in.
But are you personally, as a fan, AD, are you in favour of it?
I mean, I can see both sides of the argument. I'm sitting on the fence a little bit here. I mean, I think when you look at our squad, I think there are players, like, for instance, you look at the fact that Lallana coming off, you know, you could have put McAllister on and then you still have another twist of the dice afterwards. Yeah. You know, there is an argument for it. Obviously, the bigger clubs with the bigger squads, obviously, it is an advantage thing because they've got the better players and it gives them an opportunity. But at the end of the day, can only use so many of them. It worked okay. It worked. Graham Potter in charge, from a Brighton point of view, yes, I would like to see it because he would use them.
Okay. Yeah, I totally agree.
His tactical now would be... we come to it. Whether Roy Hodgson's got the tactical now or not remains to be seen. But well, we know the answer. Anyway, let's swiftly move on because we've got to get through the rest of this. Liverpool got a free kick at the edge of the box for a foul that wasn't a foul, which you've already talked about, which White got booked for. And then from the resulting free kick, of course, Mane had it in the back of the net. And this one was definitely offside. No argument about that one. Then Welbeck was fouled in the box. Ref didn't see it. It went through a VAR check. Stuart Atwell didn't deliberate for long and he pointed to the spot.
Funny one, that, isn't it? We're actually really getting into the realms of what is a foul. And, yeah, I mean, who was the defender? Was it Robinson?
It was Robertson.
Took a little bit of an air swipe and you could see that we're getting back to the technicalities. And the point is that a penalty, for instance, doesn't need to be someone being clattered into the box. It can be just a shove and someone stays on their feet. And you think, oh, soft penalty. We're back to the notion of, like you said earlier, AD, technically offside, but and this one is technically a penalty. And if it's technically a penalty, it's a penalty. It's just that probably the majority of us wouldn't have known to have actually screamed our lungs off for it because you think, he didn't end up doing a triple salchow in midair.
I mean, it's a foul anywhere else on the pitch, for sure. Don't always get given anywhere else on the pitch. I mean, if it was against us, I would be spitting feathers right now. But seeing as it wasn't against us, I'm here laughing.
Yeah, who knows?
And then, of course, Pascal Gross stepped up to show Neil Warbright exactly how.
Simon, should Pascal Gross be taking the penalties from here on in?
He's not guaranteed to be on the pitch, Simon.
Well... it's a valid point. It's the point exactly I was going to make. If he plays, obviously, he's got the ball. He's scored a goal. I think he's in pole position to take the next ones. And if I was the manager, I would probably have him on penalty duties from now on.
I think so.
Would you have him in the team, though, Simon? This is the question we had last week.
Yeah, it's a difficult one. I think his assist rate is unbelievable. I think we're setting a side up now where you can play Gross. What I didn't like was when you had Gross and Murray in the same side where you've got complete lack of pace completely.
Yeah.
And our forward play wasn't quick enough. So I think we can use him and I think Potter is using him and he realises he is the key that can unlock the door and he's using him for that.
And particularly as Lallana's now going to be out for a couple of weeks.
Correct. Yeah, no, exactly. So I don't think we've got much choice but to use him for that creative assist type role.
So a quick straw poll, your feeling at the end of the game? I mean, there was a late chance for Shahan Bash as well, which was deflected wide. But I mean, overall, I mean, do you feel it was 2 points dropped or a point game?
No, I think it was a good point. I thought it was a good point. It would have been a completely different story if we went 2-0, which we probably deserved to. But I think overall, we deserved the point. It would have been a travesty if we didn't get another point out of that game, particularly after the Man United one, where we completely trounced them and come away with a defeat, which must be soul-destroying as a player. So I think it was good. I think it was good for the setting up of our season going forward.
It was funny. I was in the press box on this, and I was chatting to a guy I've got to know really well from the Metro. And he said, this is the seventh time I've been at Brighton this season. The last six have been draws. I said, where do I sign? And this is before the game. I definitely would have taken that before the game. Yeah. Anyway, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 7.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. This show, as ever, is brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com, and we have a, I think, quite beautiful shirt of the week for you this week. Simon, if you could have a look at this and describe this little vintage number for me.
It is a classic. It's very vintage. You want me to describe it?
Yes,
it is. It is an Adidas with an old Adidas retro badge. Its colours are white and red with a red diagonal sash. Very French writing on the front in terms of the sponsor's name. It's a round collar, so it's red and white. Adidas, probably 1970s, I would say. And it's got red cuffs. Yes, I can. It's Alain Afflalou. It is. So it's obviously very French, I assume.
Al, you know what this is, don't you?
I do, but do you know, Simon?
I don't, actually. I'm really struggling. Is it Monaco?
It is Monaco.
It is.
Yes, it is Monaco.
It is.
I will guess from the mid-80s.
Mid-80s, later than I thought then, is it?
It's later, but yeah. Al, you're close. I would say late 80s, actually, really.
The old retro badge. That's what I liked about it.
Well, this is what Phil Shelley from oldfootballshirts.com has to say about this particular jersey. And he says, here is your shirt of the week. And a real beauty of a vintage kit. This is the 87 to 88 home shirt of AS Monaco. A bit of trivia to get you started. The shirt sponsor, Alain Afflalou, is a nationwide chain of opticians. Despite the Principality of Monaco being a sovereign state of its own right, AS Monaco play in the French Ligue 1, where at the time of writing, they sit fourth in the table. They play the home games at the Stade Louis Dirk, which has a capacity of 20,000, and they go by the catchy nickname of Les Monégasques. Can you tell me anything about about their stadium?
Yeah, I've been past it. It's got a car park underneath it.
Yeah, it's on top of the car park.
Yeah.
I have seen it. I've not been seen it.
Yeah. So the club was formed in 1919 as a merger of several teams, becoming the footballing department of the Monégasque Sporting Club, which allowed them to carry entry into the French football leagues. They're one of the most successful sides in France, with 8 league titles and 7 Coupe de France trophies. Their all-time leading goal scorer is Delio Onis, or nicknamed El Cano, who scored 223 times in 278 games between 73 and 1980. Most appearances goes to Jean-Luc Ettore, who played 755 times between 1975 and 1994. Their list of past managers reads like a who's who of football, including Thierry Henry, Claudio Ranieri, Didier Deschamps, Claudio Puel, Jean Tiganin, and of course, Arsene Wenger. There are plenty of links to UK football, including the managers I've just listed, but I wonder if there were any links to the Albion, says Phil. To be fair, these are a little bit tenuous. Really, Phil? but here you go. Defender Jean-Paul van der Heck was about to sign for Monaco from NAC Breda this summer before changing his mind and signing for the Albion. He's currently on a season-long loan at Utrecht. A former US AS Monaco Academy striker now plays for Real Union Saint-Gilloise. But that's not the best part of this link. Al, you know this one because you were tweeting about it earlier. His name is Brighton Lebeau.
Which translates as what?
Go on, Al, tell me, what does it translate to this?
Brighton beautiful.
Yes, it does. he's obviously going to sign for us next season alongside Mark Albrighton.
there was actually someone pointed out a Swedish player. I can't remember his first name, but let's call him Javier for the sake of it. There is a player called Javier Hove.
Wow. Anyway, moving swiftly on. Last week we had a competition for you, and thanks to everyone who entered. We had a massive response to this, as we always do for these ones. And last week I asked a question: what was the name of the dog that famously found the Jules Rimet World Cup trophy after it was stolen in 1966? Simon, do you know the answer to this?
It's not Pickles, is it?
Yes, it was Pickles. And Pickles is also the art of football.
I should have done it.
Yeah. And Pickles is also the art of football mascot, which is one of the designs you can choose if you win. And we did I didn't do the draw. My daughter Molly did the draw earlier on today.
Was this from a solicitor?
Yeah, and the winner is Nigel Leaney. So congratulations, Nigel. We'll be in contact and to find out whether you want a t-shirt or a print on this one. And congratulations. And all of who did enter, who wants to get themselves some art football clubber, just go over to their website. They've got some absolutely wonderful designs of all kinds of things. And they're absolutely wonderful. Okay, so last week, what did we do last week?
Well, if it was down to anyone else, I've got spectacularness. I'm obviously drunk having watched the Liverpool game because I thought we were very, very good. But if you're talking about us on our computers, we interviewed the Brighton crime author, Peter James. The new series of Grace they've finished filming, taken up probably just about everyone's traffic and parking spaces, as they upset just about every single neighbourhood in the city. But yes, so that's finished. Peter, he himself was loveliness personified, told us plenty of tidbits. Dear God, is that man a gossip? He's worse than you and I when we're drunk. And and you can listen to that as an Albion Raw podcast extra time special. If you just go to our Audio Boom page, or if you already subscribe to our podcast, then you've got it automatically downloaded. But do listen to the Peter James. If you want to see the best and the worst of your city on the television and find out all about it, then make sure you listen to those podcasts.
Simon, are you a fan of Peter James?
I'm not, but my wife is. Our studio room is just full of Peter James books. Absolutely loaded with them. I'm not sure what order they run in or anything, but she's got all of them.
Well, you've got plenty to look forward to.
I certainly have. Yeah,
you should give it a go. And of course, Peter James has got many books which you could be buying someone for Christmas. Speaking of books, though, Simon, you've got one out yourself.
I certainly have. And thank you so much for inviting me along. For simple reason, when I started the project and I had to do the PR bit, everyone said, make sure you get on Albion Raw, number one priority. So here I am. So thank you for that. Not yeah, the book is called From the Gutter. It starts life at the turn of the millennium. It's all about the Albion, following the Albion, as opposed to the footballs per se. Basically, it's a detailed memoir of an amazing journey that we've ventured on, a real amazing journey. And it comes in basically four stories, really. First one, the With Dean story, the Amex, then the Promised Land, or Premier League as it is known. And then the last bit is thoughts and prayers. And it's my thoughts on what a wonderful club it is, what a bright future we've got. And also the fact it touches on the personal things that have happened in my life as a result of that as well, in that thoughts and prayers. So that's how it's formulated. It is, as we all know from that particular period, a great time to be a Brighton supporter. Mm. Okay, the days in the With Dean were a bit up and down. We yo-yoed from League One. I think With Dean galvanised the club. It came back and we were all as one, weren't we? Those that were there, we're all part of the club, the media, the players, the fans, the board. It just seemed as one unit. And it was an amazing time. And you look at the inputs and outputs of that place. I mean, it was a joke stadium. But boy, did we exceed all expectations. We did. We had real fun. The players were amazing. I still think that League One championship win was one of the greatest things in Brighton's history, because there were some top clubs in there who went on to become Premier League clubs pretty quickly.
Southampton.
Yeah, good example. But there were others. You know, Bournemouth were in there. No, Reading were in there.
Hang on, which League One title are we talking about? Are we talking about the one in the last year of With Dean, or are you talking about the Oath?
No, the Peter Taylor, Mickey Adams combination.
Sorry, yeah.
Yeah, then. So there were some good teams in there. And you know, apart from Bobby, it was, I think, quite an even side. Bobby was obviously the standout player. But it was a real even side, and they were men. You know, we box well above our weight, I think, and we certainly punch really heavily. And we, you know, people like Cardiff went on to better things. They were in there. Mm. Wigan did as well. So it was great. So yeah, amazing story. And I can always remember going back when we got relegated to the bottom flight of the football. I was in Menorca, of all places, and I saw a report on, I think we played, did we play York again because of the deferment?
Yeah,
and I was away for that, and I couldn't go to that. So I read about the report and the demise of my football club. And we had obviously fallen into the bottom league for the first time in my history of supporting the club. And I thought it was horrendous. And I thought it would change, you know, what I thought about the club. It was like we got some sort of disease. It was just a bottom thing that I just thought we were going to really struggle to get back out of those doldrums. And we did. But if you look from that moment onwards, and if I met a fortune teller in Menorca that period of time, and they told me by 2020, we'd be sitting here with the Amex, with a brilliant academy, with a great modern squad, with a forward-thinking board, a brilliant fan at the leader of our club, and all that he's done. And that's just the football bit. And I've captured the latter part of that, obviously, from with Dean onwards. Mm. And they were amazing times. You also got then off the field, the fight for the stadium, the Falmer for All campaign. You've got the building of the stadium and all of those things. I've made notes, and they were just a great storyline, and it's too good to ignore. Yeah. So I've put it all down, and hopefully it makes sense. That's the football bit, but then there's a whole lot more of fun stories jam-packed in there. Lots of notorious away days, boys banter, and lots of things that happen on match days. You know, like the Shoreham Air disaster, horrendous thing, but that happened on a match day. Twin Towers happened on a match day. And a lot of personal circumstance happened on match days. Some were funny, some were horrendous. And they're all documented in the book. So hopefully Albion fans will enjoy it.
Okay. I mean, you said the book chronicles the Albion from the turn of the millennium. Is there a reason you chose that particular starting point? Because obviously your own personal Albion story starts beyond that.
Well, I did have a little play. I did a fanzine thing when Dick Knight, just after Dick Knight took over the club, and we got back into the WID thing. And I did that, and I raised a little bit of money for charity. It's self-published, but it wasn't to the quality or to the extreme that I'm doing with this one. So I had a little play of it, and that did the retrospective bit, as well as a couple of seasons at the WID thing. And so I always thought I would pick up, and my gutter, in terms of the story's gutter, was definitely the Crystal Palace away, which was the most expected derby ever. We hadn't played them for ages. We went there and we were an embarrassment. We were on a dreadful run anyhow, the worst in our club's history of defeats.
Are you still blaming Paul Brooker for getting himself?
Well, we can use that as an excuse, but we were completely outplayed, weren't we? We were completely outplayed. It was just a mockery. And you know, it was an amazing occasion because we took so many. They gave us the entire Arthur Waite stand. Mm. And it was a celebration. And it just, within an hour, it was so deflating. And then they locked us in. And not only did they lock us in, they then locked us in again in the streets of Croydon and marched us all to Thornton Heath. And that's where my story really starts. I have to do a retro bit, filling in the gaps when I left my last story. But then the stars is obviously the Premier League and us doing the double over Crystal Palace.
What are your memories of with Dean then? Because, I mean, we were talking about it the other day on a show about 2 or 3 weeks ago. AD, who was it with? Was it Bergs?
No, it was with Guy.
That's it, with Guy. They talk about it fondly, even though, as you're quite right, a joke of a stadium. What are your memories of with Dean? How do you look back on it?
Like you said, fun. We were all in it together, but it was fun. We were paying quite strong financial penance for sitting in the rain on a regular basis. The product in terms of the field was horrendous. I can remember Southend at home when they even brought some of the machines in from the cricket ground to try and soak up the water. It was horrendous. And
that was when the sinkhole happened in the centre.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well,
yeah. yeah. So But it was a whole lot of fun, and it was a real togetherness. I did quite a lot of corporate stuff then as well. I was sponsoring quite a few of the matches, and I just thought the whole place, it galvanised support. It was quite an aged crowd, but it was those that cared. Yeah. And the vast majority of those worked on such a tremendous campaign that gave the club a future, along with Tony Bloom's money, of course.
OK, now you say that there's some unconventional subject matter in the book. Can you give us a flavour of what that actually is?
For a start, when I started supporting Brighton Hove Albion, I didn't think I would bump into the actor that plays Mini-Me.
Troy Verne.
Troy Verne, you've got it. Verne Troyer, his name is. So he goes into the book with his porn movie as well, but we won't talk about that on air. So that was a real surreal experience. We got to Liverpool. It was an Everton away under Chris Hughton, I believe. Yeah, it was definitely under Chris Hughton. And there was a comic convention in Liverpool. So everyone was dressed around like the Hulk and that sort of stuff. And there were a few actors in the hotel that we stayed in, which is the Pullman, and he was in there. So there was that. Bristol Rovers away. We had a great time. I've got a good mate who is a gas head. Brighton won, so we were all really having fun. He showed us around his city that he's got great pride in. And the evening was then cut really cold because we saw the aftermath of a horrendous accident where a famous actor, and I won't spoil it because of the book, I was certain he was dead. And he obviously tells the story because he isn't dead. And it was a stag night that he was on. He walked in the place that he shouldn't, and the car hit him, and it threw him 12 foot in the air. And we saw the aftermath of that. And my girls, my mate's wives were there. I was there. My wife was there. And they were crying. He was dead. He looked dead. I've never seen anyone so far. I've never seen a dead person. That's the nearest I got to it. So that's a story in itself on a match day. But there's lots of boisterous away days. And one of the things I've learned, I think, really, from the book is that your love is unconditional, isn't it?
Mm.
Our love, it's like a child. It lets you down, it disappoints, it excites you, and it costs you probably about the same amount of money as bringing it up as a child.
We've often said that it's your first love, your wife, your mistress, and your child. It's all rolled in one.
But it's not always two-way, is it, with the Albion?
No, we don't do things the easiest way. And I think the book actually does that. It does that part of it justice. But we love it, don't we? And it is an amazing journey. And we've been so lucky to have a community that we've got. You know, our leaders are great. The supporters are great. And I've just had a fabulous time. And to be able to raise money for a charity that is really close to my heart. When I wrote that fanzine thing that was called Two Left Feet, and no permanent home, I started writing it, and unbelievably, my mum got breast cancer. So when I made the decision to do this particular project, I didn't have a charity in mind, but you won't believe it, lightning struck twice. As soon as I started putting pen to paper here, my wife got cancer in a really aggressive form. Thankfully, she's had a couple of operations. Thankfully, she's had the chemo pre and post-op, and she's finished it, and she's getting her life back together. But in that as well, I was starting to decide what I was going to do charity-wise, and cancer grabbed a spectacular hat-trick during the writing of this book when my sister phoned me on a Friday night prior to, I think, the West Ham game at home, and she had got breast cancer as well. So Macmillan were brilliant for my wife. She spent weeks at Redhill. And she was spending a lot of time there, and they were superb. They gave her loads of treatments. So I'm not earning a penny from this. Hopefully I want to raise a minimum of £3,000. That's my target.
So tell us about the publishing of the book itself. How much is it? Obviously, it's a self-published book.
Yeah, it is. And I need to give a plug to my printers as well, because they've given me a lot of free studio time. Yeah, it's been hard work. I admire you guys who work in the industry having done it. It isn't easy. I've had to do everything. So I've done the writing, had to do most of the proofreading, not all of it. but a good mate helped to try and get some form of order. And I work in insurance, so I've done proofreading before. But we've had to do quite a lot of things on the hoof. It's a hard game. The book is finished. It's being printed at the moment. Those printers have been amazing. They did all my design. I had an idea for the cover. They've done that. Not charged a thing for it. They're mocking up envelope stickers as well for me free of charge. So, yeah, I've had to finance the book. The book will cost £11.50 per copy, including postage and package, is £15. Okay. The industry has given me feedback that it is pretty cheap. The reason it is pretty cheap is because it's, one, my first attempt. Two is that I've offered my services free of charge. Now, I am asking for donations if people are able to do so over and beyond the cover price. But what will be, as I said, all I want to do is raise or sell the 600, give people a lot of enjoyment, give something back, and hopefully we raise £3,000.
Okay. Plus and Simon, where can you actually get hold of the book?
Right. Okay. For any orders, they're coming through me on my email address, simon-jane@tiscali.co.uk. We will be having some collection points, but they are at the moment in North Sussex, one here at my home and one at my wife's premises, which is King and Stevens Cowfold on the 8272. We are trying to find somebody that will take on collection point in Brighton, but there is also, as I said, a postage service with text facilities that people are tending, if they're not in the area, to utilise as well. So, yeah, I'm working on that at the moment, but we've got orders of creeping up to 300 already. As I said, I want to shift 600 as a minimum, and that's what the first run is, 600 units.
Sure. So do that again. It's From the Gutter to the Stars by Simon Medhurst. It's £11.50 plus PMP, which will take it up to £15.
Correct.
And to obtain a copy of that, you write to...
Simon-Jane@tiscali.co.uk.
There's also a very good link to it, which they've got as a sticky on North Stand Chat at the moment. So go on there, and you can also get it all through there.
I wasn't going to mention that, so thank you for the plug, guys.
Yeah, and you can see the details on our social media pages as well. Simon,
thank you so
seriously
much.
Good luck with the book. Hope it goes well.
Thank you.
Yes, and here's to your family as well for recovery and remission as well. So good luck with it, and do let us know how it goes.
Certainly. Thank you so much, guys, for your support. In our conversation off air, you actually mentioned me in the same sentence as none other than Peter James. I don't think that's going to happen again, despite my book being half decent. So thank you for that, sir.
Okay. So Peter James and Simon Medhurst, we get the Giants.
Absolutely. two authors in the week. Well, that is all we've got time for on this week's Albion Raw. So thank you, of course, to Simon Medhurst and Alan Wares. I've been Eddie Packard. This has been the Albion Raw on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. Bye.
Demo Lover.